In late December 1776, the American War of Independence appeared to be on its last legs. General George Washington's Continental forces had been reduced to a shadow of its former glory, the British Army had chased them across the Delaware River into Pennsylvania, and enlistments for many of the rank and file were set to expire at year's end. Things were desperate, so Washington responded to this crisis with a raid on a Hessian camp on Christmas Day across an icy river. He crossed the Delaware as a nor'easter turned up on the coast, burying his detachment under sheets of snow and ice. They attacked the Hessian brigade in the early morning hours, taking the German auxiliaries by complete surprise. Only 3 days later, Washington struck again, crossing the Delaware, barely escaping from the British at Trenton, and attacking the Redcoats at Princeton, completely bewildering them and making them ask themselves, wait, can the Colonials actually win this war? Now, the next 3 months of the war are usually skipped over, and historians of the Revolutionary War go to the Battle of Saratoga, but this period, called the Forage War, is crucially important to the forging of the Continental Army. Today's guest is Jim Semple, author of The Enemy Harassed, Washington's New Jersey Campaign of 1777, and it brings to life one of the most violent but overlooked periods of the war. Washington's Continentals and the state militias went head-to-head with the British in a series of small-scale actions and large-scale battles, eventually forcing the British to flee to New Jersey by sea. It's bushwhacking, small-scale hit-and-runs, but a number of actions that whittled down the British forces actually cost more lives than the New York campaign and turned a bunch of inexperienced junior officers into competent military leaders. These battles shed a lot of light on the Revolutionary War and show what it takes to win a war of attrition. Hope you enjoyed this discussion with Jim Semple. And one more thing before we get started with this episode, a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Years ago, I did an in-depth examination of the Revolutionary War, and there were many things that stuck out to me about Washington. Yes, he was a man of nearly unimpeachable character. Yes, he was an extraordinary leader who could rally his troops in hopeless situations, and he was oftentimes the only thing keeping the Continental Army together in cold, frigid winters. But what stuck out to me is that he was, I would say, not a battlefield tactical genius. He completely fails to protect his flanks in New York and Brandywine, and it seems like there are times where he only gets away and avoids capture or total obliteration of his forces by sheer dumb luck. Maybe a British general can pursue him, but for whatever reason decides not to. Maybe the weather changes. Maybe there's a frost that prevents the British from going. This happened so often that a co-host and I came up with a running gag that when Washington was a child, he saved the life of a woman who was drowning, who happened to be Roma, or Gypsy if you prefer, and casted a spell that gave him lifelong good luck. And the subject under consideration with your book of the Forage War, when Washington is holding the army together, we see a lot of good luck spring up. So do you have any explanation for this? Is it because he has such strong leadership ability that what looks like luck is really gravitas? Or how do you make sense of this period?
It's hard to make sense of it in exactly what you're talking about, because there are many instances where Washington is really saved by the forces of nature almost. It's hard to suggest even that that was great leadership, certainly on Long Island. The fog rolls in, everything changes for him, and he is able to escape Long Island back to Manhattan, and the British can't pursue or bring up their ships. During this period of time, it's interesting that Washington, of course, goes across the Delaware and attacks Trenton on Christmas Day and has a wonderful success. He then returns and goes back over to the Pennsylvania side and returns a few days later to march on Trenton. By then, Cornwallis, who is in charge of the British army in the field in New Jersey, is marching hard for Trenton to try to pin Washington against the banks of the Delaware River with a great number of troops. On Cornwallis's way into Trenton, the weather is warm, the roads are muck and mud. His men splatter their way through them, the mud, get there exhausted, and really can't launch much of an attack that day. Overnight, a front blows through. The roads freeze hard, and Washington escapes on those roads, and his men are able to get out of there. It's rather amazing. It's not the only instance where it seems literally like Mother Nature is watching after the American cause.
Your book deals with the aftermath of Washington's 1776 crossing of the Delaware. And this is an interesting period because it's before the Continental Army deals serious blows to the British as a proper field army at Saratoga and elsewhere. And they've evolved upward from this rabble of guerrilla fighters who dent the British army with a shot heard around the world. But they're not completely taken seriously yet as a proper power. So can you first take us to that winter following the Continental Army's retreat from New York and how desperate things really were for them on the eve of the crossing of the Delaware?
Okay, so the New York campaign had been a catastrophe for the Americans. And they retreated across New Jersey, followed by the British. Washington was able to get across the Delaware and try to reorganize, but he had gone from about 20,000 effective troops to about 2,000 or 3,000 once he got across the Delaware River into Pennsylvania. Now, it's important to understand that Congress had established the Continental Army in three different periods of time. The first establishment was when they just simply took over the militias that had surrounded Boston. The second establishment was then put into a place on January the 1st, 1776, and it went till December the 31st, 1776. And so when Washington had gotten into Pennsylvania around Christmas time, he knew that this second establishment of the Continental Army, all their enlistments were going to be off. So they were going to be marching away. Now, he was able to get a few of these troops to stay on board. He attacked Trenton before the enlistments were up. But as soon as the new year started, all those enlistments went up. Now, Congress had created a third establishment for the Continental Army, but none of them had yet to arrive. So Washington was in between one army essentially marching off and waiting for the next army to arrive. So he was really between situations there, and his troops, he had no troops almost by the time he got into New Jersey and began operating there. The second establishment had left. He was left with about 2,000 Continentals and some militia to face against an army of about 17,000 British.
After this happens, the Americans cross the Delaware. Famously, they capture Trenton. They win at the Battle of Princeton. Can you describe these events? And then what will you describe the mood like afterwards? Because this is most of when your book takes place. Are they basking in the afterglow of great victory? I live in Kansas City and we're still basking in the afterglow of the Super Bowl. Or is the mood guarded optimism but trepidation because they fear that the empire is going to strike back against them? So can you describe these two victories and then what is the mood like for the army afterwards?
Yeah, well, I guess that the first Trenton victory is pretty well known. I mean, on Christmas night or on Christmas Eve, Washington takes about 3,400 men across the Delaware through ice-choked rivers, marches about 9 miles through a howling snowstorm to Trenton. They divide the army between two different wings, one under General Greene, one under Sullivan, to enter the town from different ends. The attack goes off spectacularly well. In only about an hour, they completely run off the Hessian brigade that was there. They captured about 900 Hessians, and it was a spectacular success. It was a euphoric success for almost all the men, and they felt that initially. Of course, for Washington, he wanted to press on. He was the type, a very offensive-minded. He wanted to move on and continue attacking the British. But he was reminded by a number of his officers that his men, he may have been ready to go, but his men were exhausted. So he realized that, and they recrossed the Delaware and prepared for now another advance. A few days later, he recrossed the Delaware. He had written to John Hancock telling him he was going to press the British. He was convinced he could push them out of New Jersey. So he recrossed the Delaware and consolidated around Trenton. By then, Cornwallis had arrived in Princeton, had gotten all the troops he could gather, about 7,000, and marched on Trenton. As I described before, they marched through the muck and the mud, and late that evening, they arrived around Trenton, threw up a barricade around the town, and basically pinned Washington against the river. There was some initial fighting, but Wallace was advised not to attack because night was closing and they could easily attack in the morning and have a victory then. Washington decided he wasn't going to stick around for that. He had some information from local scouts that there were roads that led off through the backwoods down toward Princeton, or up towards Princeton, I should say. And the entire army dawdled overnight on frozen roads when the British woke up the next morning and advanced on what they thought were Washington's positions. They found nothing there. Then they heard firing in their rear and realized that Washington had escaped, marched clear to Preston, and had attacked the British contingent there. He beat them in a running fight, ran them off, and took the town. He couldn't wait for long because he knew Cornwallis would be after him in a real rush to get to Preston, because now Washington was between Cornwallis and Brunswick, which was the headquarters for the British Army, where they had all their munitions and their storage and a huge amount of silver that was supposed to take care of the army there for the entire next few years. So he was scared that Washington might get to Brunswick, and that's exactly what Washington had in mind. But like the original Trenton, Washington realized as he got to a fork in the road with his army that his men were simply exhausted. They had been marching and without food, without clothing, through the cold and snow, and he couldn't press on. So he, instead of moving north towards Brunswick, he headed off to the northwest towards the mountains, the Watchung Mountains, where he intended to go into winter quarters. His men were utterly enthused over what they had accomplished. They had beaten the British twice. They knew it. They were super happy about that, but that didn't change the conditions of the army, and Washington knew it. His men were still exhausted, and they did not have food, and they didn't have clothing or shoes or anything else. So he had won two great victories, and they really turned the war around, and they also really gave the American people a great deal of new confidence, which they had lost after the campaign in New York. So that was about the condition as he headed north into New Jersey after the Battle of Princeton.
When the two armies hunker down for the winter, there's an expectation that they won't be launching major campaigns. Before the crossing of the Delaware, their British troops are ready to winter back in England, see their family, till they're recalled. During this time, the Forage Wars, Washington gives the order that American troops be constantly harassing the enemy. First, just in general, can you describe what foraging meant at this time? Because usually Washington has to keep his men from foraging so that they don't earn the scorn of the local population and make locals turn on them. And the British do forage at different times, which does make the local, do make the locals turn on them. So in general, what does foraging mean in the Revolutionary War?
Well, at the time, armies had to more or less live off the land. So they had to go out, send parties out, to find food and certainly to find feed for their animals. That was extremely important. And New Jersey at the time was basically an agrarian society. They had great farms and barns full of all sorts of things. And so the British needed that, and they went out in force to try to get it. And Washington originally, his plan was he stayed in Morristown, which was up in the mountains, and he had his Continentals in small posts posted around Brunswick, which is where the British consolidated. Whenever the British marched out of Brunswick, militias or Continentals or combinations thereof generally attacked the British and tried to keep them from getting forage. Now, this was by and large successful, and the British had to establish a supply route all the way back to New York City because they had a great navy and they could bring supplies in. But they still had to try to go out and get some supplies for their feed for their animals, which were starting to get starved and die as a result of not having it. So it was really a fight over, it was like today having gasoline for your tanks and your vehicles. If you don't have gasoline, your army doesn't move. In the 18th century, if you didn't have feed for your animals, your army couldn't move. So that was what the fighting was about. And Washington had established posts around Brunswick. And almost daily, the British would come out in some kind of force and try to get outside. Sometimes they were successful in getting what they wanted, but every time they went out, they sustained casualties. And that's what really started to become a big problem for them. No major battles were fought during this period of time, but many, many, many significant actions were fought, large and small, to prevent the British from coming inside the state or into the interior of the state and get what they wanted. Now, the Americans lost men too, but the British really couldn't afford to lose the number of men that they were losing. And so that's called the Forage War period. The first 3 months, it was January, February, and March, during the winter months of 1777, when all this fighting was going on over forage. And the British really couldn't contemplate a strike against Washington, because by and large, European 18th century armies went into winter quarters during those months because the roads were impossible to pass. They couldn't move their equipment, their artillery, and all their wagons. And so they were just sort of hunkering down and trying to wait for the spring to come along. Washington, by the same token, he didn't have men enough to do much of anything. So he was happy to keep them confined in and around Brunswick and attack them whenever they came out.
These battles look very different from larger battles of the Revolutionary War. They're scouting and harassing operations. They look like insurgency or counterinsurgency guerrilla tactics. Can you describe if a commander were putting together a raid tactic and wanted to do a raid, what sort of plans would be put together? What would these look like in general? Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors.
Well, they were pretty haphazard, quite frankly, from what I've seen and what I've read. Often a word was gotten back that the British were moving somewhere, and an officer would try to collect whatever troops he had in any particular area. You have to understand, the militias were often mustered in for periods of about 30 days, so they were coming and going constantly. Some of the new Continental regiments were coming in, old ones were still leaving. So Washington never really knew who was up in these forward units, and that was a movable feast. There were constantly different people out there and numbers of troops out there. So his local commanders, who had a better feel for it than him, would try to gather as many men as they could. And then they basically just hunted where the British were. And generally, these were ambushes. That's what it really comes down to, sort of bushwhacking. The Americans would bushwhack them, and the British would form into lines and attack. And then the Americans would fade away into the woods and then bushwhack them some more. And that's basically what this period of time looked like. I don't know that it was really terribly well organized, but it was effective.
It gets ugly, and you see troops doing things to captured enemy troops that you don't see on mainstream battles, like the mutilation of captured Americans at Drake's Farm. Do you sense this, that there's more of an ugliness and animosity in these types of battles than you would see in large, properly fielded battles?
Yeah, the sense I got of this period of time was that British soldiers were becoming very frustrated because they were being beaten up quite often and they were losing a lot of men. And that wasn't supposed to be happening. They were supposed to be the experts in war. They were the trained soldiers, and they were losing a lot of men on these expeditions, no matter whether they found forage or not, whether they were successful or not. And they were getting very angry about it. And yeah, they would take off on wounded Americans and basically just execute them, murder them in the field. And it was getting very, very ugly. Washington protested over that any number of times to Cornwallis and to William Howe, not terribly successfully, but he was worried that it would turn into a bloodbath, that the Americans would start retaliating in kind. And that, I'm not sure that ever really happened, but the British and the Hessians in particular had a very nasty habit of being very ugly and giving no quarter whatsoever to Americans.
Not that there was a Geneva Convention at this time, but is the rationale for British commanders that while they're not engaging in the proper conduct of war, these American bushwhackers, so if they're executed on the field and they're not taken as prisoner, they weren't abiding by standard war conventions? Or are they even trying to justify it? What's the rationale look like this period?
I don't think they were trying to justify it. I think that, yeah, maybe Howe would write back and say, yeah, we're looking into this. We don't like it either. But both sides were fighting basically guerrilla-type tactics. They were fighting daily all over the place. And, you know, the rules that the European armies used weren't necessarily important or impressive to American militias. A lot of the Continental officers and the militia officers had gotten their experience fighting the Indians. And that's the type of contacts they were encouraging and the tactics they were encouraging. So they were bushwhacking, and it was pretty ugly fighting, and it was on a daily basis. And, you know, you get tired of that if you're the British and the Hessians. You're constantly on the lookout for somebody sniping at you or whatever. And so it was one of those things where they had an opportunity to take it out on the Americans. They did it. And when the Americans had an opportunity, they did it to the British. Most of the British butchery was done with the bayonet. A lot of the American soldiers did not have bayonets, so that was the difference there. The Continentals did, the militias didn't.
Like you said, a lot of the militia are operating independently, but there are times when militia are organized into larger fighting units and they can take on British regiments or battalions. One of those battles that is larger is the Battle of Millstone, led by Philemon Dickinson. Can you describe him and what this battle looks like?
Yeah, he was one of Washington's better officers. And the battle along the Millstone there was, I'm not sure which one you're actually referring to, because is that the one where you're talking about a British foraging expedition?
Yeah, the one on January 20th with the 500 British soldiers.
Yes, there was a larger one later in the spring. Okay, yeah. He gets word that the British are moving out to a farm along the Millstone River, and in a number of farms along the Millstone River. He gathers up a bunch of men as quickly as he can from around Battlebrook. They're militias by and large, but there's some Continentals with them. And they come down, they catch the British at a farm, making off with a lot of produce and a lot of forage in their wagons, and they attack them there. I think it's about 2,000 British at the time, and probably around 2,000 Americans show up and attack them relentlessly. The British have artillery up on a hill. They start using that on the Americans, and the Americans fade away after that, but they regroup and come after the British as they're marching back towards Brunswick with their forage, and really create a lot of havoc and cause a lot of casualties. This is one of the original times during the Forage War when Cornwallis started to realize that he was going to have to send a lot of men out very well armed if he was going to forage in the New Jersey interior.
A few weeks after this, Colonel Charles Mawhood, who's the officer who fought the Americans at Princeton, leads out several brigades to try to destroy this militia that had been harassing them. What does this battle look like, which this is eventually leads to the Battle of Spanktown?
Yeah, well, the fighting in and around Rahway, by and large, was along the Rahway River. It was one that fed out towards the Atlantic. The British could bring up their ships in there in smaller boats, and basically they would forge around that area and get the salt and things from farms and then abscond with it downriver. Again, Maxwell, one of Washington's generals in the area, got word of this, came through Elizabeth, drove the British out of Elizabeth towards Rahway. A bunch of militias that came down as well and attacked the Hessians and the British around what's called Spanktown now. Spanktown then, Rahway now, and attacked them. And day-long fight basically retook all the salt that the British had gotten and reclaimed it for the Continental side and hopefully gave it back to some of the farmers that it was taken from.
Something amazing about all these different battles is that one by one, they're not significant, but in aggregate, there are more British soldiers, I think, die than the Battle of New York, if I have that right. Why do you think this period was so effective for the Continental Army?
Well, it's exactly what you just said. They were not able to fight in the way they normally fought, which was to go out and fight a full-scale pitched battle. And so they were basically surrounded to a certain extent in Brunswick. And they were fighting day in and day out. And they were sending out operations to try to get food and feed for their animals on an almost daily basis. And so they were sustaining casualties day after day after day after day. And these started to really add up. You're right. In the New York campaign of 1776, the British sustained about 1,500 casualties. That's a very well-known campaign during that period. During this period in New Jersey, they sustained over 3,300 casualties, over twice as many. And that's probably a very, very low figure, actually, because a lot of the fighting was probably never really reported. It was men being shot while they were in barricades or redoubts and here, there, and everywhere. And so it's entirely possible that the casualty rate was maybe even twice that much. And we just don't know about it. The 3,300 was what was reported. So the British were being bled dry during this period, and it was really taking a toll on their army. General Howe realized that actually in early spring, and he realized he really had to get out of New Jersey or his army was going to cease to exist almost. The questions he had then were really, he wanted to go to Philadelphia, which was the American capital at the time. The questions he had were, could he march over New Jersey by land and take Philadelphia, or was he going to have to load up everyone by ship and sail away? And after the fighting in New Jersey, he had decided come late May that he was going to have to leave New Jersey by sea because he dreaded having to march across New Jersey with the militias and Washington coming down out of the mountains and attacking his rear guard or whatever, that he may not wind up at Philadelphia with many troops at all. So this fighting actually forced the British to leave New Jersey by sea in order to get and open a new campaign against the American capital in Philadelphia. And in the meanwhile, it helps Washington to a very good extent. I think when he went into the winter quarters or took position in Morristown, he had two basic goals. One was to keep his army alive until the third establishment arrived, and also to drive the British out of New Jersey, hopefully, if at all possible. And by the end of the spring and into the summer, he had accomplished both of those things, which was quite a remarkable accomplishment when you figure the state of his army in early January 1777.
There are a lot of small actions in this period. If you look at a map of the Forage War, there's over a dozen battle sites. Are there any other battles or actions that stick out to you as significant in this period?
Yeah, well, General Howe, before leaving by sea, he attempted, let me preface that by saying, in the spring, Washington pulled back his frontline posts, and he moved his entire army up into the first ridge of the Watchung Mountains, which were about 30 miles from New York, along the first ridge there to a camp called Middlebrook, for where he could observe all the British movements and so on. Before Howe loaded his troops onto transports, he decided he was going to attempt to lure Washington down out of the mountains, and with a plan of having two columns, one in front of Washington and then another sneak around behind him once he came down and crush Washington between the both. So the British marched out in vast numbers to try to accomplish this, and it failed. Washington didn't do much of anything. He just watched from above in the hills. And then so Howe pulled back all of the soldiers towards Amboy and to the boats along the river where he was going to lead. Washington then came down out of the mountains and started to follow him up. And just before Washington got very close, and then before all the troops, the British troops were loaded onto the transports, Howe attempted the same thing again. This is now called the Battle of Short Hills. He divided his army into two columns, one under Cornwallis, and Howe led the other one. One went straight up north into New Jersey to try to attack Washington. The other circled around again and tried to cut him off from behind, the idea being to be able to crush Washington between the two. But Washington got word of it and moved his main army back up into the mountains. And there were a whole series of rear guard actions fought during this period of time to hold the British back so that Washington could escape back to the Middlebrook encampment. And the British lost a lot of people this time. It was a very hot period of time. They marched all around New Jersey, accomplished virtually nothing. And that's when Howe decided he was just simply going to march back to Amboy and vacate New Jersey, load his army up onto the transports and head south.
Scott here. One more break for a word from our sponsors. Collectively, all the battles in this period, like we said, are significant, but many people skip over it because there aren't any famous generals involved here. We don't see cameos from future presidents. Most of the battles are rather small. In the case of the series that James Early and I did on key battles of the Revolutionary War, we went from the Battle of Princeton and skipped over to Saratoga. But what would you say is the impact of this period and the larger scope of the Revolutionary War? What was the importance of the Forage War?
Well, the importance of this entire period was, number one, I mean, if you look at the Revolutionary War, it's a war on the American side of survival, quite frankly. Yeah, there's some good victories that are won, but by and large, it's 6 years of survival. Washington understood he couldn't lose. He could have a draw here and there or whatever, but he couldn't lose. So it was a period of survival, and Washington was able to get the third establishment of the Continental Army together, drive the British out of New Jersey, and Wise began to fight again. During this period of time as well, a lot of his junior officers got real serious training in fighting, which a lot of the people on the American side did not have. A lot of these people were not, very few of them had training in fighting. They were bookkeepers and librarians and shopkeepers. And so they got a lot of real hands-on training in how to fight against the British. And that helped them with the officers there. The American army still was not a real serious fighting force in the European sense and would not be until the winter of 1777, 1778, when von Steuben turned them into that. But the junior officers got a lot of training, and the men in the ranks got a lot of training from going up against the British. And when they could go up against the British and the Hessians and come away victors, even in small combat, it gave them a lot of confidence. So it was a huge boost morale-wise, and they survived for another day.
And I think it's in this period when recruits are signing 3-year enlistments instead of 1-year. Is that correct?
No. The first two establishments were 1-year enlistments. And after that, Washington decided we couldn't have this. We have to have a professional army. And they started signing up for longer periods of time. But the first two establishments were for 1 year only.
Well, this is a critical turning point, and that the military is able to survive this long is something of a miracle, especially when you consider what they're faced against. What do you hope that readers take away from this book?
Well, first off, this is a period that's hardly even well known. I think the reasons for that are, like we've sort of covered here, that, you know, it was sandwiched between two important periods when there was fighting that everybody knew about. There was Trenton and Princeton on the one hand, and on the other hand, there's Brandywine and the defense of Philadelphia. And this is sort of forgotten in between them. There are no major battles, so it was sort of lost to history. The people of New Jersey, the militias, and the Continentals fought very hard against the British during this period of time. It was really, really a revolution of the people as much as it was anything. And they were able to accomplish a great deal. I was very much impressed with how much the people fought and the conditions under which they fought. I mean, you hear about men, you know, with no shoes and no clothes, sleeping in the snow on rocks after they had marched 15 miles during the day. It's awesome to think about how they survived that and the endurance they had and the spirit they had to do all this. It was a very inspirational period to me, and I was really awed to read about it and to write about it.
This period, one among many, but especially this one that's often overlooked, really is the forging of the military and what makes it become the fighting force that is eventually able to win. Well, there's a lot more in this book you could get to, but for listeners who want to check it out, the name of Jim's book is The Enemy Harassed, Washington's New Jersey Campaign of 1777. Jim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
All right. That is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.